Thank you for watching this sermon recorded at Holy Innocents Episcopal Church during one of our principal services. The sermon is based on the lectionary readings for this Sunday. To stay connected to Holy Innocents, friend us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter, or check out our website. Thanks for listening, and stay connected.
Be seated. It's wonderful to be with you. It's a special day. You know what today is, right? St. Bridget's Feast Day, of course. Saints aren't just a football team, right? But I came from Philadelphia and Camden, where we have a Irish Catholic parish we're a part of, and I'd get in big trouble if I didn't mention that. We do have a wild Catholic priest that has gone to jail many times and taught me what it means to be kind of a holy rebel, and I've been learning for the last 20 years, I guess, really, how to follow Christ, and as I listen to the scriptures this morning, I think part of what we're always trying to see is if we have the ears to hear the words of the prophets, right? And I think of the word prophet as it means the mouthpiece of God, right? And we see Jesus speaking with that authority this week, being presented in the temple, and people were astounded not by just his words, but by his life. And I heard one theologian say, I think so well, that the gospel spreads best not through force, but through fascination. And as we think of what it means to be Christian in the age we live in, I want to suggest that it means that we fascinate the world again. And I think if it's true that the gospel spreads through fascination, we also, I think, kind of have to admit that over the past few decades, our Christianity has become less and less fascinating to a lot of the world. I mean, we can think about why that is. I think some of the loudest voices haven't always been the most beautiful expressions of the faith. Some of the most beautiful have been the quietest. But I think in the end, we can see that we have a little bit of an image problem in the world. You know, the Barna Research Group is kind of the, you know, major polling company in much of Christianity. They went to every state in the U.S. a few years ago, and they asked young non-Christians, what do you think of when you hear the word Christian? And what they heard is heartbreaking. The number one answer of what young non-Christians said when they heard the word Christian is Christians are anti-gay, anti-homosexual. Number two is Christians are judgmental. And number three is Christians are hypocrites. I'll stop there because the list doesn't get much better. You know, but that we are out of touch, we're irrelevant to the world that we live in, we are prudish. These are the things that people said. And what broke my heart as I read that list was that I'm pretty sure those are not the things that people thought of when they encountered Jesus. You know, they didn't walk away scratching their head going, why doesn't he like gay folks? You know, or why is he so judgmental? People were fascinated and magnetized by his love. And that's the next thing that struck me as I read the list of what people thought of when they heard Christian. What didn't make the list was the one thing that Jesus said, they will know you are mine by your love. And love didn't make that list, nor did most of the fruits of the Spirit. And so I'm so excited to be alive at a time right now, though, where I think that there's something stirring in the church and in the world. And it's a movement of young people and old together saying, we want a Christianity that looks like Jesus again. We want to not just speak, but we want to incarnate. We want to embody God's love in the world. And I think in the end, our challenge is not just one of words, but one of embodiment, right? That we've heard the words of the prophet. We've got Jesus all around us. Even God printed on our money. But in the end of the day, I think we've kind of forgotten what is at the heart of our faith, this love that Jesus says they will know we are Christians by. And so as I grew up in the Bible Belt, I started to see some of the contradictions around me. You know, that we still, even in the heart of the Bible Belt, sometimes we still are haunted by racism. You know, as Martin Luther King said, one of the most segregated hours in the world is 11 o'clock on Sunday morning. We can see that this instrument that's meant to be the primary conduit of God's love, we don't always live up to that. I saw some of the ways that expressed itself now as I am getting to know folks in prison and on death row that sadly what has happened is that the things like the death penalty have not succeeded in America in spite of Christians, but because of us. You know, 85% of executions are happening in the Bible Belt. And we think of Warren Hill, who was executed here in Georgia this past week. And so as I've studied that, I've wrestled with what does it mean to follow Jesus again? And so I ended up going after where I saw Christianity expressed best. And for me, I really liked Mother Teresa. You know, and when I think of the great Christians that have marked history, many of them I started to notice in the Catholic tradition, and folks, you know, like Bridget and Mother Teresa. Mother Teresa happened to still be alive when I was in college, and so as some of you may know, we just wrote her a letter and said, we don't know if you give internships. But we'd love to come work with you, you know. And when you're 20 years old, no one's convinced you that anything's impossible, right? So we just wrote, and we waited, and every day we would pray that we would get a letter from Mother Teresa, and that letter never came. But that didn't bother us. We were stubborn and young, so we just started calling nuns on the phone, trying to get a number for her. And eventually we had this old nun in New York. I guess she thought we were cute, and she said, here's a number for India, you know, good luck. And so we called India, and I was calling from a payphone, and young people, these is what we used to call people on. You put quarters in them, and we called, and I'm expecting like kind of a polite greeting, you know, Missionaries of Charity, how can I help you, or something like that. And I just heard this raspy voice answer the phone, hello. And running out of quarters, I started talking fast, you know, and I said, I'm calling from the United States. We're trying to come work with Mother Teresa. We wanted to get hold of one of the nuns in Calcutta. Can you help me? And she said, yeah, this is Mother Teresa. And I'm like, and I'm the Pope, you know. I started asking, well, we're trying to figure out how to follow Jesus. And we feel like we've got a thing or two to learn from you. Can we come work? And she said, yeah, come on. And, you know, start asking what seemed to be logical questions to me. You know, where are we going to sleep? What are we going to eat? And Mother Teresa didn't fret about a lot of that. So she just says, well, God takes care of the lilies and the sparrows. God will take care of you. I don't know how you argue with that, you know. I was like, thank you, Mother Teresa. I'm not sure how my mom will do with that, but I appreciate that. You know, and so we went, and I've been a couple of times now, but we went to India, and I think what was so amazing, I mean, there were so many things. I worked in, you know, the places I had read about, and the home for the dying, and the orphanages. I went to the village of folks who had leprosy and skin diseases and spent time with them, and in the end, I began to realize, like, that one of Mother Teresa's truest phrases was, you don't have to go to Calcutta to find Calcutta. Calcuttas are everywhere if we'll only have eyes to see. And so her prayer, whenever she commissioned to go back where they were from, she would say, I pray that God would help you to see your own Calcutta, to find your own Calcutta, to see the pain, the loneliness around you. And so I think one of the most powerful things we learned is that Calcuttas are everywhere. And we came back to Philadelphia, and we started our little community there. And really, over the past 20 years, I think what we've been discovering is the art of spiritual formation, really to form people in the way of Christ, like to begin to live as if Jesus meant the things that he said. You know, I mean, that to read the gospel with an innocence and say, what if Jesus really meant the Sermon on the Mount, that we're not to store up for tomorrow what people might need today, but we're to live like the lilies and the sparrows, we're to love our enemies. What if Jesus meant this stuff, you know? And over the last few years, I think it's really, it's kind of thrown our worlds out of whack. You know, all the time I meet Christians that are like, oh, my life was such a mess. I was doing all this stuff. I went to jail, and then I met Jesus, and everything came together. I'm like, God bless you. I mean, for me, I pretty much had my life together, and I met Jesus, and he messed me up. You know, like, I'm reading the gospel, trying to figure out what it means again. You know, like if you want to be the greatest, become the least. I began to see things like in Luke's gospel, Jesus says, when you have a banquet, when you throw a party, don't invite all your friends and your relatives and your rich neighbors. Invite the poor, the lonely, the marginalized, the outcasts. I mean, I read that and I'm like, really? You know, like... And so much of our life has been trying to reorient ourselves to the margins rather than the center, you know, to find that God is alive in the forsaken places, not just the centers of wealth and power. And what a counter-cultural idea that is, you know, that I heard one pastor, you know, just after the Christmas season, Advent and Christmas, he said, we began to see that Christmas is a strange time because we end up spending all of this money buying stuff for people of everything to celebrate the homeless baby Jesus. He said, we were getting ready to have our Christmas service this year, and the strangest thing happened. He said, we had the whole place decked out. I mean, decorated with lights, Christmas tree, wreaths, you know, all the colors of Advent. And he said, and then I was praying on the altar, and he said, I felt clear as day, right the week before Christmas, the Christmas service, he said that God wanted me just to tear it all down. He's there will be a few angry church ladies, you know. And so he said, I started taking down all the decorations, and this is the night before the Sunday service. And he said, and then it got weirder. I felt the Spirit compelling me to go out to my farm and get a bunch of the manure and come back and redecorate the altar. And he said, I'm not one to say no to God. So I did. I went out and I piled up a bunch of the manure, and I brought it back and I put it on the altar. I put it all over the aisles. He said, I came. And then the next morning, it was awkward. You know, everybody came and they're wearing their best dress clothes and, you know, coming to the Christmas service, and they're smelling the manure. And he said, but then it happened. It was one of the most powerful services we've ever had. The Spirit spoke to us. You've forgotten the story. The story is about the God of the universe leaving all of the comforts in heaven to be born in a manger. As little children, the holy innocents, right, are killed all over the empire. That this story is a story about the one who was born in the manger because there was no place in the inn. It smelled a little bit around him, and he knew the pain of earth. He said, this is what the Spirit taught us that Sunday at Christmas. God was born into the crap. God was born into the pain, and God is calling us into the suffering and the pain of the world. Everything else in this culture is going to try to compel us to move away from the pain, away from the suffering, away from the neighborhoods where people, where there's high crime or people that don't look like us. And yet the gospel calls us, compels us to grow into the pain. And I wonder, you know, what does that mean for us today? As we look at a country that is beginning to pay attention to the residue of racism, to see the pain that right now one in every three young black men is in prison, over 2 million people. We see the pain around us. We hear the names of those who have suffered from injustice. We see the patterns of violence and militarism, and we begin to think, what does it mean to bear witness of God's love? And I'm convinced that Karl Barth was right, that we've got to read the Bible in one hand, but we've got to read the newspaper in the other, and that our gospel should compel us not to escape this world, but to engage it, right? To dive into the pain, to care about every injustice that's happening around us, to say, God, give us the eyes to see the Calcutta that's right here. And I think when we do that, we begin to fascinate the world again. They begin to say, who are these people who call themselves Christians? Why do they hang out with those people? Why do they advocate for those people? Why do they go to jail for those things? Like, why do they talk about grace when it seems like they should be talking about an eye for an eye, a tooth for a tooth? When we look at the gospel of Jesus, I'm convinced that it is in the darkness that we become the light, right? We bear witness of God's love and light. So I'll leave you with one little last image of this. This is a Tennessee image I remember growing up. My grandfather was a farmer, in a very kind of wild and innocent man. Everybody loved him, but he was always doing just bizarre things. And I remember this one day as we were bush hogging, you know, making hay. My grandfather had this brand new truck and trailer, and he said, "We're going to break this thing in today. We're going to bale a bunch of hay," you know. And so we started piling the hay bales on, and eventually we had gotten as many hay bales as you could get onto the back of the truck, and it was like really starting to sag. And they hit the highway, and my grandfather was in the passenger side, my uncle's driving, and they're, you know, listening to their country music, and then they begin to notice that that there was smoke coming behind them because the trailer had begun to drag on the tire and catch the hay on fire. And it's hay, right? So it starts to become a blazing inferno behind them, and there's fire trucks following them, you know. And then my uncle got this great idea that we'll just shake the fire off, you know. And so he starts shaking the truck. I mean, great idea, you know, and it's catching fields on fire. So now there's like lots of fire trucks behind them, you know, and they're trying to put the fire. Eventually they end up, you know, getting it contained. And my grandfather says to me after he got out of jail, "Shane, we caught half of East Tennessee on fire this week." And my first thought was, who is this man? You know, but then I thought, like, as I went to sleep that night, I thought, what a great image of the kingdom of God, right? Not that we should be pyromaniacs, but that we should actually be living in ways that leave a trail behind us, that leave a trail of God's love, that fascinate people with the light that burns inside of us. And so that is my prayer today, is that we fall so in love with Jesus, the light of the world, that fire starts to burn in us in a way that the world around us takes notice again, not because of how we've spoken out against the hot button issues, but about how we've loved people in ways that interrupt the status quo, right? That interrupt the patterns of injustice, so that a generation from now, it's my prayer that people, when they hear the word Christian, they will not say anti-gay, judgmental, and hypocritical, but they will say love. Love. May it be so.